just as the viewpoint of the biblical creation story is earth-centric, as though someone was standing on earth to record God's process of creation. So as Zechariah winds down, the viewpoint reduces further to Jerusalem-centric. Earth, so far as we know, is the cosmic center of physical life in the universe in any form we can think of it or know of. And please do not take this to mean that the Bible excludes the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe, because the subject just simply never comes up. Why? As I said, the Bible and the story of creation revolves around planet Earth. Now, assuming that Earth alone has physical life other than some type of microbe, then God has declared Jerusalem as the cosmic center of spiritual life and the most holy place on earth. It is the sole place where he chooses to put his name. And as we approach and enter into the millennial period, and then 1,000 years later, the new heavens and new earth happens in a re-creation event, still Jerusalem remains the center of redeemed and reconfigured life and of God's presence with us. And I might add, this is all the more reason to support the modern state of Israel, the Jewish people who live there, and for us to pray continually for the peace of Jerusalem, which God commanded. Now, I think it's helpful to occasionally pause and reflect on what was going on in the rest of the world at the time God is speaking through Zechariah. Judah and Jerusalem were not isolated. They were part of a huge empire, the Persian Empire. The world was aware of the Judeans, and the Judeans were aware of the world. And that said, the known world at that time pretty much ended at the shores of the Atlantic Ocean in Europe to the west, and the region of India and then China to the east. For those who lived in Judah, now called Yehud, and Jerusalem, the familiar part of the world generally amounted to what was ever the extent of the Persian Empire. So as we near the end of the book of Zechariah, and prophecies about an end times that could be anything from imminent to near to a very long time away from the first hearers and readers of his prophecies in 500 BC and a little later, just realize that whatever they mentally pictured about what it may look like, it was only within the context of the known world. And whatever level of political, societal, technological development that existed for them. In all cases, this has everything to do with the wording of all that Zechariah has to say. It's no different for us as we look to the future for what the events of the end times strike when they do in earnest. We can only envision those prophetic words according to the world and the societies and the technology that exists and that we know of today, even though things might be very different by then. Now, around Zechariah's era, 500 BC, the world was undergoing profound cultural, political, technological, and philosophical changes that would alter and shape the course of history. In Greece, this is what is now called the early classical period, a time of intellectual awakening. The city-states of Greece, especially Athens and Sparta, were rising in power. A form of democracy was beginning to take root in Athens as they laid the foundations for modern political thought. At the same time, Greek philosophers such as Heraclitus were questioning the nature of the universe, setting the stage for Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. To the east, the Persian Empire was more or less at its peak, stretching from the Indus Valley to the Aegean Sea. The Persian kings implemented an efficient administrative system and built infrastructure like the Royal Road to unify their vast empire. However, tensions with the Greek city-states were brewing and on their way to soon erupting into the Greco-Persian Wars. In India, the Mahajanapadas, large regional kingdoms, were flourishing. Buddhism was emerging. Siddhartha Gautama, who would become the Buddha, was probably still alive, spreading his ideas of compassion, non-attachment, and enlightenment. Hinduism was evolving during this same period of time. In China, the Zhou dynasty still ruled, but real power was shifting to feudal warlords during what became known as the Spring and Autumn period. Thinkers like the great Confucius were active, offering teachings on ethics and family and governance that would define Chinese philosophy for centuries to come. Europe in 500 BC was a mosaic of mostly tribal cultures, a few early civilizations, and a couple of emerging powers, with different regions experiencing widely varied stages of development. The transition from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age was well underway in the more advanced parts. In Africa, the Kingdom of Kush thrived along the Nile, trading with Egypt and other Mediterranean civilizations. Communication between all these regions was occurring. Zechariah was at least partially aware of it all, as were the typical common people. Now let's keep that in mind as we work to bring the book of Zechariah to a close. Now we left off at verse 14 last time, explaining that the complete Jewish Bible translation is quite wrong, as it has Judah fighting against its own capital city, Jerusalem. Other translations do a much better job with this verse and explain it as the residents of the territory of Judah fighting alongside the residents of Jerusalem. Now, frankly, to take this any other way makes no sense at all, and it defies everything said before and after this verse. See, this in itself is a lesson. Lesson to be learned from Bible students. When a verse makes no sense, or defies the context or even logic, then be skeptical. Most likely, it has been poorly translated. Often it's a matter of a translation team attempting to make passages compatible with whatever group or denomination is sponsoring them. Or it represents the doctrines that they personally believe in. Other times, it's just poor translating that isn't actually agenda-driven. Now, next, as we proceed to the conclusion of the chapter and book, the general focus is about Jerusalem's, Judah's, and even the Gentile nations' futures. There has been so much negativity and catastrophe for Jerusalem and Judah, all owing to their unfaithfulness to God. But now this turns joyous, positive, with the negativity and catastrophe being turned away from Israel and towards the nations. And as always in the Bible, the term the nations means every nation in the world except Israel. And the chief characteristic of the nations is that they are Gentiles and that they worship false gods. However, these immediate passages only concern the relatively few survivors of Armageddon and of God's cosmic wrath being rained down on the entire planet. Yahweh, as a warrior God, has been the emphasis thus far in Zechariah. This morphs now into Yahweh as more or less a political king over a subdued earth with all of its varied civilizations and populations. Now, as believers, we are all acutely aware of the lion and lamb metaphors used to characterize Yeshua. His nature, his missions, that is, he is both a fierce alpha predator and a meek, humble sacrifice, all rolled into one. And the Bible overall depicts Yahweh as both warrior and king rolled into one. This is part of the reason why David is so highly revered in the Bible, even God calling him a man after his own heart. So, thus, just as Yeshua's first advent was as that meek sacrificial lamb, his return will be as a fierce, ruthless lion. And so in Zechariah, God first is depicted as warrior, and now that the battle is won, as king. As another reminder, we should take these various metaphors as concerns God and his son and even heaven lightly, and not too far or too precisely. Not the least because that is how metaphors work in any language. A metaphor is an approximation. It's not a synonym. All of these many terms in the Bible concerning the Godhead and heaven, the Godhead and heaven, are taken from the only sphere of reality we have to concoct our images and illustrations, the physical human sphere. So they're limited and imprecise. We also find in the final verses of Zechariah that holiness becomes an all-pervading condition of Jerusalem. And at least some parts of that holiness become extended to all nations. Now we are going to see that finally the remaining people, the survivors, will grasp what many of us have already come to understand. It is that all who want to worship Yahweh necessarily must take on an Israelite identity. Why? Because it's only with God's covenants with Israel that mankind can have peace with God. This, as always, does not mean converting from being a Gentile to a Jew, nor does it mean taking up Judaism. It has nothing to do with our genetic makeup or our family line. It's a spiritual identity, for the lack of better words, that God looks for. The ideal Israel, the Israel of God, has always been of a spiritual nature. Okay, so let's read more of Zechariah chapter 14, starting at verse 15. Zechariah 14, starting at verse 15. A plague like this plague will also affect the horses, mules, camels, donkeys, all the other animals in those camps. And finally, everyone remaining from all nations that came to attack Jerusalem will go up every year to worship the king, Adonai Sefaot, and to keep the festival of Sukkot. If any of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, Adonai Sefaot, no rain will fall on them. If the family of Egypt doesn't go up, if they refuse to come, they will have no annual overflow from the Nile. Moreover, there will be the plague with which Adonai will strike the nations that don't go up to keep the festival of Sukkot. This will be Egypt's punishment, and the punishment of all the nations that don't go up to keep the festival of Sukkot. And when that day comes, this will be written on the bells worn by the horses, consecrated to Adonai. And the cooking pots in the house of Adonai will be as holy as the sprinkling bowls before the altar. Yes, every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be consecrated to Adonai Sefaot, and everyone who offers sacrifices will come and take them and use them to stew the meat. And when that day comes, there will no longer be merchants in the house of Adonai Sefaot. The matter of plague again surfaces, and it extends to domesticated animals. And when it speaks of the plague, it likens it to the plague spoken about in verse 12. Recall that verse 12 of Zechariah 14 said, Yehovah will strike all the peoples who made war against Jerusalem with a plague, in which their flesh rots away while they are standing on their feet, and their eyes rot away in their sockets, and their tongues rot away in their mouths. So something similar is going to happen to this list of animals. Now, these animals are used in the Gentile military camps of the nations. This is not including Israel. This list of animals is limited to beasts of burden, not to livestock used for food or food production. So these are animals that the Gentile nations' militaries are using. That said, after this listing of beasts of burden, the plague is also to affect the other animals in the enemy's camp. This indeed does refer to the food animals that militaries of that era always brought along with them. Bottom line, the means of the enemy nations for transporting soldiers and supplies will be wiped out, as will their food supply. Now, verse 16 is a remarkable verse. It refers to all the survivors from Israel and from all the nations. That is, every still living person on earth that comes out of the war of Armageddon and God's wrathful judgments. The implication is that even the surviving heathens will turn to worshiping the God of Israel. See, it's most interesting that despite what follows, most Christian commentaries from long ago to modern times will term what happens to the survivors as a mass conversion. From whatever was their former beliefs to Christianity, thus making the entire earth Christian. And it will be Jesus that they worship. What the verse says is that annually, there is to be a pilgrimage to Jerusalem by representatives of all the nations on earth. And there they will worship the King, Yehovah of hosts, and done so at the time of the biblical Feast of Sukkot. No mention of Jesus, no mention of Christianity or anything like it. In fact, it's the opposite. It is Sukkot, a biblical feast Christians long ago denounced and renounced, that is the occasion for the worldwide pilgrimage. Christianity has its foundational creed that no Jewish feast is to have any role in the faith. And in fact, all those feasts and laws and commands and so on found in the Bible were abolished by Jesus. And as we go through Zechariah and unpack this final chapter, all that man-made doctrine of Christianity is put to shame. But it doesn't stop Christian commentators and pastors from simply deleting God's formal name from the chapter and replacing it with the word Lord, which, of course, is then further declared to mean Christ. Now, why is the Feast of Tabernacles singled out? Now, while I can't say with 100% certainty, it is my position that as the seventh and last of the biblical feasts, it will be the final one that Yeshua brings to its fullest prophetic fruition. I've spoken before that it seems to me that Sukkot, which also goes by the name of the Feast of Final Ingathering, represents the entry into the millennial kingdom era. And this is the same as the final harvest spoken of in other prophecies and in the New Testament. This works well with the next verse, verse 17, that says, if a nation does not send representatives, that nation will receive no rain. Now, one of the main purposes of the Feast of Tabernacles celebration is to beseech God for rain, to ready the fields for the next planting. This was visibly depicted in what is called the water libation part of the ceremony. And in this ceremony that occurred on the final day of a seven-day long Feast of Sukkot, the high priest would go from the Temple Mount down to the bottom of the hill where the Pool of Siloam was located. There he would fill a vessel with water from the pool, go back up a quite long series of steps to the Temple Mount, and at the altar pour out the water as a psalm was recited. And it was this ceremony that was a plea to God for rain at the proper time for the next new agricultural cycle. No doubt, this is what is going to happen again in the millennial temple era. Now, there's much controversy about this passage because it flies in the face of 16 centuries or more of church doctrines and decrees, but also because of the blatant erasure of the Father's name, replaced with the standard church word for the Son, which is the Lord. And if you'll remember, we found this same thing at the beginning of chapter 14, when we hear that literally Yehovah's foot will touch the Mount of Olives, causing it to split. But the church has declared that it's not really speaking of Yehovah the Father, but rather of Jesus the Son. Now, interestingly, in verse 18, the same issue is brought up. What happens if a nation doesn't send representatives to the millennial temple annually at Sukkot? However, this time, it singles out Egypt. Now, the first thing I want to take from this is that despite all that's happened, disobedience and rebellion to God will still exist among many human beings. Otherwise, there's no point of a warning against disobedience. Okay, we must keep in mind that during the 1,000-year reign of Messiah in Jerusalem, that there will be basically two kinds of people living on earth. There will be those who have returned with Yeshua from heaven in glorified, incorruptible bodies. And there will also be people who are regular humans, born and never having died yet. Those regular humans will be no different than all those we interface with in our current lives each and every day. And this will be the same planet Earth that we're presently on. And if anything, it will have become greatly scarred by war, and it'll take several years for the cleanup and rebuilding and for the land to heal itself, just as it does right now. And to be clear, the millennial temple and Yeshua will be here on the same earth we now inhabit. Most humans will be the same, even if some have determined to worship the God of Israel. But there will also be those who died in the past, came back with Yeshua in their new glorified bodies. Now, Egypt is a special case for a few reasons in Israel's history, and it would continue to be so in a time well after Zechariah, including Egypt providing a hiding place for Yeshua and his parents, as King Herod the Great sent out searches for them that he might kill the young Yeshua. There's not a lot of point into going into all the different scenarios where Egypt was involved with the development of Israel, both positive and negative. For God, Egypt sits in a slightly different category of nation, a bit above nations in general, certainly below God's set-apart nation of Israel. And notice, too, the awareness that while most nations in that era depended on rain to water crops, Egypt, at least on the surface, did not. But for that matter, neither did it for people who farmed between the rivers in the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia, as they drew most of their water from the Tigris and Euphrates River. But Egypt depended on the Nile more than only for its water. It was also for its overflow. See, they had built canals and watered their crops out of the Nile River. The Nile was the most critical lifeline for Egypt, as it literally brought life out of the desert sands. The Nile was much more than only water. The overflow brought with it its rich silt to nourish the crops, because Egypt is mostly sandy soil. And the production level of its crops would have been far smaller if not for that silt. It is said by historians that if there was no Nile, there would be no Egyptian civilization. It would be like the middle of the Sahara Desert that sees only a few hardy souls traverse its width and length, as there is little water there and farming is fairly impossible. Population growth depends upon drinking water and food supply. And yet I must say this. When we recall that this was written around the 5th century BC for people living in the Middle East, the known world for them was most limited, and they likely did not understand that the Nile overflow also depended on rain at the right time. It's just that it had to rain in areas thousands of miles upstream at the headwaters of the Nile. The flow begins from the vast Lake Victoria that covers parts of modern-day Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda, and it goes north, traveling over 4,000 miles before emptying into the Mediterranean Sea. So its complexity is far more than the Israelites and most other people groups were aware. Nonetheless, we should assume, rightly I think, that since God, who is the one giving the prophecy, of course knows this, then Egypt and its unusual way of watering crops can be taken as a type. So the overall idea is, whatever or wherever the source of water for agriculture might be, disobedience to the command for all nations to send representatives to Jerusalem for Sukkot would bring harsh penalties that would greatly affect that nation's food supplies. No exceptions and no ways to get around it. This is what is emphasized by verse 19. Now, one final thing, just as something general to notice in the Bible when it speaks of nations or people going to Jerusalem. It always is in the manner of going up. Yes, Jerusalem is at a high point in Israel, but there are places higher yet in Israel as well. And for many mountainous nations, Jerusalem isn't very high at all. See, the term going up has a ritualistic sense to it when speaking of Jerusalem. It isn't so much going up to Jerusalem, the city, as it is going up to the temple where God dwells. Thus, for instance, in modern times, where a God worshiper can certainly travel to Jerusalem for the festivals, yet the city isn't the point. It's the temple. And since today there's no temple, then the Torah commandment to go there for the pilgrimage feasts can't be met. Thus, in this passage, it is about going up to what that newly built millennial temple will be. Now, what we cannot escape at this point in Zechariah is the universal nature of God's rules. It was several decades ago when, as a mainstream Gentile church-going Christian, I had the first realizations of this. And it wasn't from reading the Old Testament that I saw it, because per church instruction, I stayed pretty much away from it. Yet I knew I had a lot to reconsider. Listen to just a few of these New Testament passages that long ago caught my attention. Romans 2, starting at verse 12. All who have sinned outside the framework of Torah will die outside the framework of Torah, and all who have sinned within the framework of Torah will be judged by Torah. For it's not merely the hearers of Torah whom God considers righteous. Rather, it's the doers of what Torah says who will be made righteous in God's sight. For whenever Gentiles who have no Torah do naturally what the Torah requires, then these, even they don't have the Torah, for themselves are Torah. For their lives show that the conduct the Torah dictates is written in their hearts. Their consciences also bear witness to this, for their conflicting thoughts sometimes accuse them, sometimes defend them, on a day when God passes judgment on people's inmost secrets. According to the good news as I proclaim it, he does this through Messiah Yeshua. See, this passage states that God will judge people, not just those who have the law, Hebrews, but also those who have never even heard of it. He will judge based on their deeds because their deeds are judged based on the principles of the same law that's written on their hearts. It also makes clear that even those who do not have the law are judged by what they do, demonstrating that the standard of behavior, our morality, is from a universal source for all humanity, the law of Moses. Romans 3, starting in verse 19. Moreover, we know that whatever the Torah says, it says to those living within the framework of the Torah, in order that every mouth may be stopped, the whole world be shown to deserve God's adverse judgment. For in his sight, no one alive will be considered righteous on the ground of legalistic observance of Torah commands, because of what Torah really does is show people how sinful they are. But now, quite apart from Torah, God's way of making people righteous in his sight has been made clear, although the Torah and the prophets give their witness to it as well. And it is a righteousness that comes from God through the faithfulness of Yeshua the Messiah to all who continue trusting. For it makes no difference whether one is a Jew or a Gentile, since all have sinned and come short of earning God's praise. So these verses clarify that the law's purpose is to reveal sin and to stop every mouth from making excuses. It emphasizes that while by the works of the law, no one can be justified, no one can be saved before God, yet it is the law's rules and commandments that define what sin is and is not. It defines what is good and evil. And it matters not whether one is a Jew or a Gentile. Sin, all judged from the same standard, the law, condemns us all. Again, the effect of the law is universal, not only for Hebrews. Matthew 5, 17 through 19. Don't think I've come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I've not come to abolish, but to complete. Indeed, I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not so much as a yod or a stroke will pass from the Torah, not until everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these commands and teaches others to do so will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever obeys them, so teaches, will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. This verse is among the most plain and explicit in all the Bible, Old or New Testament, about the ongoing, universally applicable nature of the law of Moses to humanity. Even going so far as to make it clear that however much one embraces God's laws and does them, versus however much one rejects God's laws and does not do them, this will have a significant effect on which kingdom societal level one will be assigned to in the eternal future. Now, there are more verses about this matter of the universality of God's laws, but that's sufficient for my purposes. Here in the words approaching the end of Zechariah that are speaking directly of the time after Armageddon and in which the millennial period has begun, we read that all nations are subject to God's edicts, just as it has always been. But the nations also have always been rebellious against God's edicts. And finally, strict obedience to the Feast of Sukkot is used to point this out, such that to not obey him will have a drastic effect upon that entire nation. The final two verses of Zechariah are these. When that day comes, this will be written on the bells worn by the horses, consecrated to Yahweh. And cooking pots in the house of Yahweh will be as holy as the sprinkling bowls before the altar. Yes, every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be consecrated to Yehovah Zebaot. Everyone who offers sacrifices will come, take them, and use them to stew the meat. And when that day comes, there will no longer be merchants in the house of Yehovah Zebaot. See, holiness is the subject and focus of these final verses. Holiness will pervade and guide everything to do with life and every obligation we have to God and to our fellow man. This is a universal holiness that's being prophesied. The question that I say is largely not answerable with a high degree of certainty is whether this implies a worldwide universality of holiness or just universally holy within Judah and Jerusalem. It was most intentional that the end times indicator that is used throughout Zechariah, which is on that day or when that day comes, appears twice. Wants to open this two-verse stanza, the second to introduce the final sentence. The people of the prophet's day needed to get it super clear that this is speaking of the future. And so we also need to grasp this reality, even if that future probably is rather near at this point in history compared to what it was in 500 BC. It doesn't help us that in the complete Jewish Bible we find the phrase consecrated to Yehovah. That is, the word consecrated is used rather than the more straightforward holy. That is the meaning of the Hebrew word we find here, which is kodesh. Now, it's important that in this ancient time of all the fundamental guiding principles of the Hebrews, it was that there is a large distinction between that which is common and that which is holy. Therefore, holy to Yehovah is mostly assigned to objects and items and sometimes to places that have to do with the priesthood and or the temple. Recall that on the golden headplate that the high priest wears, the phrase, holy to Yehovah, is written. In the first 8 chapters of Zechariah, the thought evolves of there being a connection between the holiness of the priests and the removal of people's sins. Here in the final part of Zechariah, we find that idea carried over and applied to some of the most unlikely things, such as horses, bells, and pots. It was meant that we notice how far from the expected sorts of sacred things that horses and bells and pots are. That is because, as we have seen in several places in Zechariah, there are these strange reversals that take place in the end times. Here, the reversal is so mammoth in scope, it's difficult to wrap our minds around. It is that the distinction between holy and common, sacred and profane, evaporates. Even the most common things, such as clay cooking pots, will bear the equivalent of the high priest's headplate that says, holy to Yehovah. Yet why horses and bells and pots in particular? See, we need to focus more on the horse than the bells it wears as a decoration. In Zechariah's era, horses were nearly exclusively used for war, usually pulling chariots. Thus, whereas the future age of the millennial kingdom will be characterized by universal peace and harmony, a horse is universally characterized in that era by war and political aggression. What is being symbolized here is the end of strife between nations. The end of settling of differences or the playing out of the national political ambitions of a ruthless national leader by means of war. That's not hard to see. But why the mention of the bells? Because part of the high priest's garb, in addition to the golden headplate with "Holy to Yahweh" written on it, were bells attached to the hem of his garment. This further cements the idea of holiness that now exists within former battlefield instruments of war as much as it does on the high priest. Now, the term pots in Hebrew is seer. Pots can be imagined as generally being divided into two categories: that which is sacred and used in temple ritual by priests. Apart from that are the pots that are common and used for all sorts of other reasons, like cooking food or washing things, by everyone in Israel. But even on a scale of holiness, holy pots assume the lowest level of holiness. Thus, the higher level ritual pots are usually called basins, such as those used to catch the blood of the sacrifice, and they will no longer be above the holiness of the temple cookpots. And as verse 21 continues this thought, it widens the scope to include ordinary cookpots in the homes of those living in Jerusalem and Judah, and by extrapolation, probably everywhere. It is most informative that ordinary cookpots unearthed from digs in Israel at places like Hazor, Megiddo, Arad, occasionally were found with the word Kodesh, holy, written upon them. It is believed by many archaeologists that these were pots used to cook the remains of sacrifices that had been given to the temple. That is, several kinds of sacrifices of animals allowed for the priests to have a portion of the meat, but then also for the lay person who brought the animal to have some too. And it may be that the lay person's portion of this sacrificed meat was cooked in a pot that had been specially set aside at home exclusively for this purpose. If it's true, it goes a long way towards explaining why a seemingly ordinary cook pot would have the word holy written on it. Now, as for the holiness that all ordinary cook pots will have, it follows that all that is cooked in them will have the same holiness status as the meat that had been sacrificed on the altar. The holiness of pots becomes universal among God's people rather than as it used to be, when it was really only the temple pots or pots set aside strictly for cooking sacrificed meat. Now, one final matter. The last sentence of this chapter and book say that there shall no longer be. And then depending on your Bible translation, it will say merchant or Canaanite or trader or trafficker. The Hebrew word being translated is Canaanite. See, very often in the Bible, Canaanite is a euphemism for merchant, which is a nasty epithet. Canaanite was essentially a dirty word because merchants were seen as so dishonest and money-grubbing. But here in verse 21, I doubt that's the intent. Rather, I think this is indeed speaking about the Canaanite ethnic group, or better, likely all non-Israelite ethnic groups living in the land. So this probably is referring to foreigners who have finally let go of their false gods and ungodly practices and become followers of Yahweh and his son Yeshua. Well, this concludes the book of Zechariah, which seems to be the middle book of a trilogy. And that trilogy is Haggai, then Zechariah, and finally Malachi. Therefore, our next study of a Bible book will be the prophet Malachi. Okay?